Okay. Did you guys know that? Are we recording? We are recording. Okay. Did you know that you were episode 430 in Learning Together?
Wow.
We do now. Mm-hmm. That's brilliant.
Now everybody knows.
When did you start then, if it's 430 now?
2010.
Okay. Yeah. So almost a decade. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My plan was to do one a week. I started out doing one a week. I've certainly fallen off of that. It just became a strain, but it's certainly not a strain to spontaneously do things as things come up.
Yeah.
And Hannah Kamis is, she's doing her, Nile Tesol events, and she's getting some really nice speakers, and she asked me to just do it in Zoom for her. So now we're partners in that. So that's coming up, and plus a lot of other things. Now EVO is starting, Electronic Village Online. Mm-hmm. So with that, we're going to have lots of recordings as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of them in Minecraft. But anyway, as someone said, enough about me. Let's talk about my blog. No, seriously, let's talk about you guys. That's a surprising one, eh?
That was good.
Yeah, so... Anyway, so I've got with me, by the way, I have to always say the date when I'm doing a recording. This is the 21st of November, 2019. And I'm here with Stephen Herter and Philip Shigeo Brown. And there they are. And they're with ITDI. What does that stand for? You tell me.
The International Teacher Development Institute.
Okay.
It's a mouthful, so we use ITDI.
So what was your journey? When we talked before, you asked me, how did I get where I was? How did you get here?
I came over with a company that was called I Will Not Complain.
A company from Japan.
Company run by a British guy. And the name of the company was I Will Not Complain. And I worked with them for a while. Mm-hmm. And it was back in 1989. And they wanted people to teach them English. So none of us knew anything about teaching English. So I had a friend in Osaka, and I said, I'll go down and spend 2 weeks with him and learn everything there is to know about teaching. Mm-hmm. And that was 30 years ago, and I'm still trying to learn stuff.
Mm, sure, aren't we all? Yeah.
Aren't we all? Yeah.
Yeah.
Phil, what's yours?
After graduating, I just had a year in Japan as part of my course, and I really wanted to go back, so I thought I would go and teach for a year. By chance, my mum, she'd been working in like an adult education center, and she said, well, why don't you go and get a CELTA?
She's Japanese, eh?
Yeah, my mum's Japanese. So I did my CELTA just between finishing up university and graduation. So I was actually a pre-service CELTA and went out to Japan. Turned out I didn't actually need it for most of the jobs I applied for, but it was still useful and good to have done. Started off in the Eikaiwa industry, which is the conversation schools, private language schools in Japan, and ended up deciding after a couple of years that actually I love my job, so that's what I wanted to do as a career. Mm. And 20 years later.
For me, it's 40 years later.
Right? Wow.
We kind of got these little 10 stages, right?
Yeah, I'm at 30. So that's it. 20, 30, 40.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. Okay. So where did ITDI come from?
Wow. I want to tell just a quickie story about my first time meeting Phil.
All right.
When's the first time you met Phil?
Was it like 2007?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, 2000 on a telephone call.
Was it a Skype call?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a telephone call. Maybe it was Skype call, but anyway, we both took the University of Birmingham in the UK. We both took their online distance master's program. And I was either a year ahead or behind. What was I?
You studied after me, I think.
Okay, a year after.
2006.
Yeah. And so one of our teachers on that program came to Japan quite often. Every summer, we had a week-long study down in Hiroshima. And we both got to be friends with him. And he said, you two need to know each other. And so he put us together. And then I think Phil called me, or I whoever called whoever. And we talked for about an hour. And 15 minutes into the call, Phil was arguing with me about different things. And I'm saying, who the hell is this guy arguing with me? And I got off the phone call going, he seems really smart, but I'm not sure I like him.
Arguing then, about what?
I can't impression I make.
And then we ended up working together on an event. We had to organize an event together with another cohort, and then we kind of fell in love with each other's strengths and weaknesses, and have somewhat become brother-like since then. What's your? Do you remember anything of that first phone call?
I have absolutely no recollection. I just remember that, there's a professor at the University of Birmingham, and he said to me, hey, look, you know, the study groups that I'd been organizing in Tokyo, Yokohama, like face-to-face study groups, and actually I'd been invited to and then just ended up helping out with organizing and so on. And he said, yeah, you've got to meet this guy down in Osaka, who's been doing kind of what you've been doing, but online with study groups. And, you know, they've seen a 10% grade increase amongst the ME
students. It was a 10 point, actually. Yeah. Vance, this was the coolest thing, is that we all worked by ourselves on the first module. And I had both my wife and my teaching partner at the high school who sat across from me, both of them in the second week of my readings, tell me, would you just please shut up? Just stop talking about it. And that's what I was struggling. I needed to talk about all the stuff I was reading.
So this is it's an online distance MA.
But
you weren't really in touch with anybody or
nobody. Uh-huh. Nobody. So I was driving my wife and my teaching partner insane within the first 2 weeks. So I sent out I had a list of all, there were 35 people who had started at the same time. I sent out an email, got no answer, sent it again. I sent four or five times, and finally five people agreed, and we just started meeting every Monday night on Skype, talking through the readings. And we ended up doing that for 3 years. And our average was like 65. The British system's notoriously strict, right? And a 65 was a merit kind of decent. And anything over a 70 was called a distinction. And you felt lucky if you ever got over a 70. So our little group talked through the second module, and we hit a 75 average.
Wow.
Which is just unheard of. And then this kind of sent a ripple through the university. But to me, it was all about the power of anything I can do, we can do better.
Yeah.
So that became a bit of my own motto.
And so this was in 2007 to 2010.
2007, 2008, 2009. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that was basically your first community of practice. And is that kind of what got you interested in...
into collaboration.
Yes. And so did you use it with students as well, or have you just been doing this with teachers?
Yeah, so what happened was that basically we got put together with a tutor on the distance program,
and like a big brother big sister kind of person.
A guy called Paul Moritoshi, and basically we kind of got suggested by the university to see what we could come up with. And we thought, well, why don't we organize some one-day events for people to do, like a mini conference? And so we started organizing a couple of mini conferences for students on the MA program and helping kind of connect people through the country and across different brackets and so on. And they ended up being really kind of successful and very, very nurturing.
We were a little evangelical about it, right? Because we were getting so much out of the interaction.
So this was basically, we founded what was called MASH Collaboration, and which stood for Meet, Ask, Share, and Help. It was all about doing those four things, which we're still very much at the core of what we do now.
Still and working then on we Skype? Did that.
Yeah, we did face-to-face.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, to collaborate and organize things, we did a lot through Skype and Google Docs and so forth. And then after doing that a year for people on the program, we thought, well, actually, why don't we open this up to
anybody in Japan?
Because we were sure that there must be other people doing masters and having similar experiences of wanting to connect and struggling with different things. And we just thought, yeah, the cross-pollination would be great. So
these people are doing masters at in the same program?
We just opened it up to whoever wanted to collaborate for further their professional development.
Sort of like an MA book.
Yeah.
Right. Like Facebook MA book, mm-hmm. I guess. And then that...
Well, that brought us to around 2010.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we organized an event called the MASH Equinox.
Mm-hmm.
And that was... What's that?
That was about 10 days.
Yeah, it was a 10-day event all over Japan. And it,
online or?
No, face-to-face event, four or five different venues.
So we managed to live stream a couple of things. We recorded. Yeah.
And this was like 10 years ago when live streaming was not easy.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
That's how we kind of got working with Scott the first time.
I just was going to say that was the introduction to ITDI. Is that we all read tons of stuff during our MA. Mm. And I remember vocalizing when I read Scott Thornbury's How to Teach Grammar book.
Mm-hmm.
And we pretty much read it from cover to cover, 150 pages or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting to the end and it was riveting. It was a real page turner because it was engaging. It was fun. It was interesting. I remember specifically getting to the last page and saying out loud, okay, I'd like to meet you. I bought into it. I'd like to meet you. And then the idea came up is let's contact him and see if he'll come to Japan as a headliner for this MASH Equinox event. And he was thrilled because he had been looking for reasons or he'd been looking for a vehicle to come out to Asia because he had done all his work in Europe to that point.
And we collaborated with Jalt on that one, right?
With Jalt and with a couple of chapters in Tokyo. Mm. And so he came and it was kind of a weird conference in that most conferences let everybody present in order to attract people, But we actually had 4 days in Tokyo and Scott did 6 or 7 full-on presentations during that day. So it was sort of all about introducing him and his ideas to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually at that event in 2010 that we were all, we went from our little study group to spreading it out over Japan for anybody through MASH collaboration. And then there got to be a little group of 4 or 5 of us who said, let's consider taking this online and adding the teacher training element to it. And that's what we pitched a full idea to Scott. And he came on at the time with Chuck Sandy. Have you ever run into Chuck?
Yes, I have. Yes.
So Chuck was one of the original founders and then another Gareth Knight in Bangkok and then Barb Sakamoto. And, so we put this whole thing, and it literally took us 2 years because we wanted to write a whole bunch of online lessons that people could do some kind of self-study with. So it was 2 grueling years. We had no LMS. We had to actually build one on our own. And we had to actually, we went through professional writers, professional editors. Right from the very beginning, wanted everything to be as good as anything else that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
That was what was going to help us survive, is being really good. And we all had kind of similar standards of wanting to make it as good as we could.
This was called ITDI at the time.
The name and the logo and stuff got put together in 2010.
Oh, okay.
It literally took us 2 years to build all the material.
Mm-hmm.
And we launched in 2012. Mm-hmm. And we launched online in 2012 out of Brazil.
Hmm.
Yeah, which was funny.
Who was in Brazil?
We had a whole bunch of friends that were really keen. We launched at Braz Tissol. Mm-hmm. And they had a room dedicated to ITDI at that conference.
That's in 2012.
Yeah.
I was there in 2010. The Braz
Tissol. Wow. Cool.
So one of the really interesting things was I wasn't involved in the founding of ITDI as such. I got married in 2010, and then
you had
kids,
better things on your mind.
Move house, get married, have kids all in a row. So, just to clear up, so MASH collaboration continued as what we were doing, but we kind of let it go to rest a little bit. Mm-hmm. Although we're still working on book projects, kind of connected with MASH collaboration, and they also do it. There's a couple of courses that they run online as well, we did. To help with publishing and bridging the gap between MA students and, you know, getting further in your professional development. And then the ITDI was a completely separate entity.
I want to add something just because it's really important here, like what you just said about helping MA students. Hmm. Most people took an MA in order to get a better job. Hmm. And a lot of the better jobs were at universities in Japan. Hmm. But the minute you went for an application or an interview, you needed to have 3 publications. And a whole bunch of these people who were just getting an MA had no publications. Mm. We saw a big gap. Mm. So we actually had a couple of the tutors actually run how to turn your essays that you wrote, your research and your essays in your MA, how to get them published. And that's, people were thrilled to have that opportunity because they couldn't find it anywhere else.
Yeah, it was a very unique course. I took a course and was on it twice, basically.
Yeah,
And it was invaluable.
But it really filled a niche for those people that needed, they had an MA in hand now, but they had no idea how to, that was a whole different game. Publishing, right?
Yeah, definitely. So that was the academic publishing side. I guess that's our first experience of actually monetizing something or doing something online that was paid for me and Steve. That was pre ITDI. Mm-hmm.
We used WebEx.
Yeah, right.
And WebEx was about $150 a month back then.
You mean to mount a course or to pay for it?
Just to get the online option. We're paying $150 a month to be able to hold a course online, which is insane because now we're sitting in Zoom here that's free.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But you were getting that back. You were monetizing this.
Yeah, so that's what we had to figure out how to make a course. I mean, that was one of the first instigations. Well, we want to do this online, but the only thing that can actually do it is WebEx right now.
Uh-huh.
That we had tried Blackboard, we had tried a number of different solutions at the time, but WebEx had the functionality that we needed. Plus, we wanted to get somebody that knew what they were talking about, and they didn't have the time, to just do it all volunteer.
Yeah. Right?
So we basically monetized it so that the teacher got enough to make it worth a lot of time, as you know, putting into anything, a lot of time to do a 10-week course with a dozen or more students, and then to make it so we could cover our costs as well. That was interesting.
Yeah, you know, that's a real issue. I helped edit co-edited a book on teachers in resource poor areas. My area was the UAE, but I was had other writers from Sudan and Iran and places like that, and then I'm working now with people in Egypt, and knowing the economies in those places and how you know, the things that they're usually writing about is for professional development. Yeah. And you've got people there who are passionate about professional development.
Yeah.
But they have, and you get a lot of people turning up for professional development, but they're not making a lot of money. There's always a question is how do they have time for it? You know, what's, because they have, you know, they're working so hard in their
just trying to make ends meet, right?
It may be that teaching is not their only job, you know, so they may have another job somewhere. So where do you have time for professional development? You know, so I really admire those people who are leading the way in these countries and helping people to overcome this mindset, you know, like, and then it's in a way, so it's very important to have free avenues for these people. Now,
yes,
you provide them, don't you? You have a scholarship program.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we tried to figure out was that how many people could we give a scholarship to, either a full, you know, pay nothing or pay what you can. Mm-hmm. And so we've really kind of tried different things. Mm-hmm. And what ended up feeling right was that if we get 7 people to sign up, that covers the costs to run stuff and to split some of the money among the people who are running it, and allows us to give 3 people a full scholarship. Mm-hmm. So we basically came up with, over trial and error, that up to 30% of anything we were doing up until that point would be full scholarship. So we had a scholarship button, and it was a part of our principles. We had our own kind of mission statement and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we really felt strongly that everybody deserves the same opportunities as long as they have an internet connection. Mm-hmm. If they didn't have an internet connect, we couldn't go there and help them. But that sort of, once internet kind of became you know, ubiquitous, that mm-hmm. we decided that would be one thing that we would always do, and do more. I mean, we've done other events where everything, like the summer school, for instance, where it was hundreds of hours on the organizer's part, but everything was free, and that was just sort of an outreach project on our part, a thank you to mm-hmm. a whole bunch of people that had been working with us as mentors or associates. We came up with kind of different names for different people doing different activities in our website or in our little community. Sorry, I'm wandering. Rein me in, mm-hmm. Phil.
Well,
where would you like to take it, Vance?
In my situation, I've been working in the Gulf, and the salaries are good. I got actually into online teaching in California. Uh-huh. And the reason I did that is, I might have mentioned, is I moved from, I'd been teaching for 10 or 20 years and moved to California to work in a software company. And I missed teaching so much that I got into, I started just working online, because online was just coming on at that time. This is, we're talking turn of the century here. We're talking 1990s.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, then from there, I went back to the Middle East and started earning money again. So I was comfortable. And yet I had this passion, which, because just like you guys, I like to share my knowledge with teachers, and I didn't really need to monetize it myself.
Right.
So, and working with other people who are doing that, and working with a lot of people who, I mean, just from our Webheads group, for example, that.
Yeah.
When we transferred it to Groups.io, which we just did, we discovered we had 300 bouncing members. I could have seen that from Yahoo Groups, but I never bothered. I did check it long ago, but it was so much trouble. I didn't really care about the bouncing members. So, but anyway, I found out that we at least we've got 700 real members there. So that gives me some sort of base of people to understand where they're coming from. And I get the impression that there are a lot of people there who are really trying to help one another. They're appreciative of whatever opportunities they have. And So I've been really kind of trying to work with these people. But then on the other hand, you know, now that I'm in retirement, I got enough to move here to Malaysia. But, you know, do start thinking, what are we going to do now? You know, especially when.
Yeah. Which is very much what, when this started. I mean, I thought, you know, we're either going to get squished by the big publishers who do teacher training and everybody's dabbled online. But I think that I was trying to think ahead, you know, I've got to retire at 65. And if we could make this sustainable so that as long as I was, it's almost like a co-op. You know, a space that people can come in and offer their expertise and charge for it at a not a gouging kind of way, but at a sustainability kind of way, and offer scholarships for people. We actually on the scholarship form, it says, how much money do you make a month? And we got teachers saying, I make $200 US a month. So we might say, well, if you would like to, how much would you like to pay for this scholarship? And they'll say, how about $10? And we'd say, yeah, that's great. Thank you. And that just, we learned that people who paid even $5 would end up finishing the course much more than people who got it for free.
Yeah. And sometimes people get it for free, don't even show up to the first one.
Yeah. Well, there you are. I mean, you know, the how many MOOCs do you sign up for and just don't go? I mean, you don't have to, but or you just go until while you're interested, you learn something, but then things come up. You don't feel obligated to. I mean, you're a statistic at that point, you know. The statistics don't really point, I don't think, to the do anything wrong with MOOCs, because a lot of people do matriculate, and you know, if you got 1,000 people in a course and 20 people matriculate, that's actually good.
So we looked at, we didn't look at it very long, but JOLT in Japan, the Japan Association of Language Teaching, has been going on. This year's was the 45th national international conference. So they've really expanded over time to a big national teachers association. And we looked at that very briefly and thought, oh, just the bureaucracy involved with the Japanese government and everything. We wanted to be a small group that found a niche and could make decisions quickly and be nimble. And so we ended up going, and we looked at, like, ETS is a non-profit, who does TOEIC and TOEFL. They're a non-profit organization. You know, just blow your mind. You know, they take in millions and millions of dollars a year, but are registered as non-profit. Well, you know, so we didn't want to play
that
game.
They pay themselves salaries.
Got a
lot of profit. You just...
I mean, same as a lot of charities as well, you know, they still have directors' fees and so on to pay. I think fundamentally, you know, ITDI, what I always liked out of ITDI from the outside when I was first heard about it as well, obviously I knew a lot of the people involved. So I knew the people involved were stellar. Secondly, ITDI was always about being for teachers by teachers. So it was always kind of people who would understand where you're coming from in terms of professional development and what you need, and would have walked in your shoes. And so very much it was always a social enterprise. And I think as we're looking at, you know, if you look at definitions of social enterprise, generally it's like a cause-driven business. And, you know, the primary reason for being is because of the social objective about doing good and serving a community that is important and meaningful to us.
And that's a whole different business model. Hey, that wasn't around a few years ago.
Yeah, it's certainly not kind of in common or in people's consciousness, I think.
Because I remember you saying that, Phil, and I immediately got offline and looked it up and said, geez, we're a social enterprise, that it's not driven by making profits. It's driven by some kind of, you know, cause. And our cause is pretty clear to us, that we believe all teachers deserve, you know. I had a teacher from Indonesia tell me they had one opportunity a year and they went to, I won't say any names, but big publisher day. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the one day, they got on a bus for 10 hours and they got to the venue overnight, got to the venue in the morning. They sat in the audience, a bunch of authors and teacher trainers presented their textbooks, and they shook hands and they got a signed copy of the book and they got on the bus and went home that night. That was their professional development for that year. And we just somewhat arrogantly thought we could do much better than that.
Well, of course, that's their formal professional development, and a lot of people leave it at that. And then a lot of people are out searching for other ways to develop themselves, which has been something I've done throughout my career. I didn't really think that there were a lot of people I was working with who were, they always seemed a little bit behind, you know, because they weren't really, because the way you did it when you started out, trying to crack that MA, doing it socially, that's the way, that's really, that adds a lot to the mix. In fact, that's why you can, I mean, it's why you can go on to MIT and you can get a course and you can study brain surgery if you want, but actually you go there and interact with people, it's a completely different thing. Or, you know, the MOOCs are, MOOCs are like that, especially the CMOOCs. I don't know, are you familiar with the CMOOC, XMOOC? You did WebEx, that's an XMOOC platform. Mm-hmm. But I, when you did it, did you use it as a delivery platform, or did you socialize with the people? Did you collaborate with the people when you did your WebEx?
Yeah, we had collaboration going on, and we had forums as well, right?
Yeah, forums.
So basically, I mean, we took a lot of the experience that the good experiences that we had forums on our MA course as well. We could see that if people got involved in the forums, and this is the key thing, is getting people involved and warmed up in forums, then the forums were great. I posted all the way through my MA. I think I posted 250 plus posts.
And I read them all one night. I remember I went in and said, and I just said, who's this Phil guy? Jeez, he's Shakespeare.
And then there was, but you know, I was great because there was about four to six other guys who I'm still in contact with,
Dax,
awesome, and friends with. Yeah, Dax Thomas, John Racine, and
Michael Salavera,
and there's a guy David Nehart in Spain. And you know, they just kept replying, and as long as they kept replying, I kept posting. They kept posting, I kept replying, and we just had this momentum. And I think, you know, finding that is quite lucky. It's quite an amazing thing. And so the university as well, when they went back to Steve and us going back a little while, they would say, you know, how do we replicate this? And they tried a number of times over the years. They're saying over the 20 years, even going all the way back to when people were doing distance learning by fax, and saying that, you know, how can you get people involved in collaboration that they feel is beneficial to them? And basically, it's either solving a problem or serving their needs. And sometimes that need is just to connect with people and talk about things that aren't actually particularly relevant to their course that they're studying, but just feel connected with people who are in it together.
But I would argue, and nothing against what you've said, I agree with all of it. I would argue that I've thought a lot about how did our online study group last for 3 years and not fall apart and not, you know, get acrimonious or, you know, and there was all kinds of leadership involved and trust and shared responsibility. All the stuff that's written about in the leadership field, we just sort of did naturally. It's just the good communication, the work ethic, the teamwork, all of these kinds of skills that some of us had more of, but everyone had some kind of contribution to that kind of momentum.
So I guess from all these experiences, we've tried to really think about how do we do that with online collaboration today, and what kind of platforms and opportunities can we make and provide that make that happen?
That's because the wrong model is the kind where, I mean, like the place I was just working in UAE, they have their training programs and they also require teachers to do some professional development. but it has to be something that it has to be, they want you to go through the courses that they put on.
Right.
Okay. So now that's the wrong approach, because I don't want to take courses that they tell me what I want to know. I want to take mm-hmm. courses where I can do what you guys did. I want to learn something and, you know, well, I mean, that's my, the way I learn. I really like, I like the CMOOCs because mm-hmm. they're so social, and they also, Dave Cormier is a good proponent of CMOOCs, and he one of his latest, what he was on about was community as curriculum. He did something called Rhizomatic Learning, Rhizo 14, I think. So that was back then. Rhizo 14, he did a Rhizo 15. But he was talking about community as curriculum. So I've mm-hmm. taken that model into our Minecraft MOOC. Mm-hmm. As I produce a syllabus, but it's not really the curriculum. The curriculum comes to you when the community mm-hmm. forms.
Right. And so you negotiate it with the community, basically.
Yeah, but it takes somebody like Heike, for example, who's yep. got a lot of experience with this kind of thing, and she does an ITDI course, mm-hmm. and yep. she brings with it this modality of, so that when people come, you know, she has a program that you go through, but mm-hmm. she's experienced enough to where you start forming interactions with other people there. So, yeah. and you,
but make, she creates that sense mm-hmm. of security where mm-hmm. people are willing to take a risk or, right. you know, we found Penny Ure mm-hmm. did a course with us 2 or 3 times now. Mm-hmm. And I counted in the first week she had our biggest course so far, where we had, that was before we knew how to cut off the scholarships. So we had 75 students in this course, mm-hmm. and Penny was answering every one of them in the forums,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, mm-hmm. and it, I counted in the first week, I counted 1200 messages mm-hmm. among from Penny, from all the participants back and forth with each other. And it just, it scared Penny. She said to me, is it going to be like this every week?
Yeah. So it's basically, we had tasks like, you know, post, make your post and then comment on 2 other people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then that kind of just goes exponential.
Takes on a life of its own.
But it's really crucial to creating that kind of collaboration and sense of togetherness and get that community. I just want to backpedal a little bit, Vance, for anyone sure. who's not quite sure, including myself. You've mentioned CMOOCs and XMOOCs. Can yeah. you just summarize in a nutshell what they are?
Yes. The first CMOOC was in 2008. Mm-hmm. It was a MOOC. It was a course, actually, that Stephen Downs and George Siemens were doing at one of their universities,
mm-hmm.
and they were teaching it as part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And they just decided that George Siemens wrote his connectivism, a learning theory for the digital age in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of laid out the tenets of connectivism in that article, a very nice article. And so that's 2004, 2000, and 2007, George was starting to put on online conferences for free, which uh-huh. was really novel back then.
Mm.
And in 2008, he and Stephen were teaching a course at a university where they just decided, well, why don't we just open this up to everybody? You know, because like what you're talking about, you've got people, you could do this yourself. You could have people who pay for a course, and what they get, of course, is they get the interaction that Penny is giving to her people one-on-one. You get the attention mm-hmm. of the course person,
mm-hmm.
And you also get a degree from it. You know, you get some mm-hmm. acknowledgement. But then what they did is they opened up the course to anybody who wanted to join, because what they wanted to do is they wanted to bring the students that were in their course, they wanted to get them in touch with other people. They wanted to widen the circle,
mm.
kind of like the way you guys did, learning, cutting through your MA readings. You know, they wanted to bring that into the mix. They believed in it very strongly. And they ended up with thousands of people. And so that didn't faze them at all. Because they figured they could scale it. So what Penny is doing, she's not scaling. She's into right. each mm-hmm. person. But if you can scale the course in such a way, especially when you have people who aren't paying,
mm.
They organized it in Stephen Downs writes scripts. He's kind of designed his own LMS. He calls it Grasshopper. Mm-hmm. It has an RSS in there, the GRSS hopper. So it's an RSS feed aggregator. Okay. And so he scripted it in such a way that he produced first of all, he has people that have to sign up for it so that anything he aggregates, they aggregate it on the conference tag, which was CCOK, and a CCK08, sorry. And so anything that was tagged CCK08 and was registered with the course, they could aggregate it. So they avoided spam that way. But basically, he aggregated it in a newsletter, and mm-hmm. he produced, it got people connected, and mm-hmm. They didn't have to attend. They figured that model scales, you know. So it's instead of being teacher down to all the different nodes suddenly start connecting with each other. And when you have thousands of people, everyone's always asking, where's the center? Because the problem with a MOOC is it's got so many things going on that you don't mm-hmm. really know where the things are. And it's also, if it's a big MOOC like that, you'll get people who kind of come together on their own. Mm-hmm. So it's not really... That's where the community of as curriculum, the community as curriculum comes along, is that some people might not really want to know how to do artificial intelligence, but they want to learn. You know, they want to meet other people, and then what they do, and then they find common things, and you learn a lot just from the people that you're interacting with. So yeah. it's not really a business model, you know, but it works on the fact in this particular case that they had a course in a university, and they got this model to where it worked and scaled. And then, of course, they took it off into lots of other CMOOCs. So they've done this over and over again. And I'm running Minecraft MOOC kind of as a CMOOC right now. I don't have the aggregator like that, but basically, we help people as we can. But I should. That's not really fair.
C stands for community or collaboration.
Open online course MOOC. Sorry, that stands for course. I was working with open online course. Yep.
Yeah, so the course. For the MOOC for the massive open online course, but the yes. C MOOC before.
Connectivist.
Connectivist. Okay,
Connectivist, right. And the X MOOCs are the ones that were sort of derived from Sebastian Thun, who was the Stanford professor who quit his job, his tenured position to go work for Google, and then he develop WebEx or which one it was?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, one of those. So then he taught a course on artificial intelligence. I did pull that out of my, but basically it was a course that actually turned out degrees for people. So that kind of organized massive teaching where people, there are algorithms that figure out what people are doing and making sure that people are on the program. So you can't just go in and matriculate, you know, you have to do the things that are required.
Right.
And it scales over, they must have online grading components. I think they,
right.
So they, but anyway, basically could track what people were doing. But that's the XMOOC. So it's also a massive online, open online course. That's the idea. Open course means anybody can go and do it. Mm. So, but I like the, well, there's also W3 Schools. Are you familiar with them?
No, I wasn't actually.
W3 Schools, mm-hmm. it's been online for, probably 10 or 20 years. It's it teaches programming. So it's got all these tutorials for programming languages. Uh-huh. Really nice things, like they got little sandboxes where you can go in and you can stick in some code and you get an output from the other side. You can change the code and you see the output change. You know, so it's yeah, it's really cool. You can do that all you want. You can go play in it and learn. But if you want to get any kind of certification that says you did that, you have to pay them, which is fair enough. You know,
so that's kind of like
we tried that. Yeah, we tried that one well, right? mm-hmm. on the summer summer school, mm-hmm. and we had like 20 people a day presenting. It was kind of like 24 hours a day, trying to hit different time zones, and we had volunteers hosting who were in different time zones. And we did something like, at the end of it, if you wanted to get a certificate to fulfill the professional development hours you had to do for your teaching institution, pay $19 to get this or $29 to get that. And there wasn't much interest in it at all. People were totally in there. I mean, totally into it. Some people were there for like 8 days in a row or something in August. They're, you know, saw every session, but they didn't, they weren't looking for the validation of it. They were looking for the buzz.
Yeah. And the learning. People love to learn. They hate to be taught.
Yeah, there you go. That's
quite often too.
Yeah, there you go. Just a funny tidbit, talking WebEx and Zoom and stuff. But the owner, the head of Zoom was actually an engineer at WebEx for about 10 years, and talks about how he learned all the problems of the user experience, which we had a number of problems as well. It was just the best we could find. Right. There was all kinds of things it couldn't do, or it didn't do, or it wouldn't do. But he took note of all of those, and that's why we're in Zoom tonight. And you know, for me, Skype is a thing of the past now, because Zoom is just so darn good.
It is, yeah, for sure.
And so he was an ex WebEx guy, and learned from them, and then eliminated all those problems when he made Zoom.
There's some things that are worth paying for. You know, I mean, Zoom I find is worth paying for. And I mean, you can have it for free. You can schedule, let's see, I'll give you two URLs. We'll do this one for half an hour, then we'll go to the other one and we'll finish up over there.
Yeah.
So we could do that. You know, you can just keep rolling your... But, you know, people, I think it's worth paying for, you know, so it's not that expensive, with a couple $100 a year or something like that.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Yeah, so what about for the, let's say the teacher's room, where you do four sessions a week somewhere, right?
For a month.
Right now, for a month.
So basically, we launched in 2018. And we started off with four a month on the same day. Mm-hmm. And then in the second year, we decided to try and offer 2 days with two different times to, you know, reach out to more people. But then that's pretty hard going for, you know, for each of us to commit an hour a week and so forth on the same day every week for 50 weeks of the year, pretty much.
But one of you takes a Saturday, or so every other Saturday, and every other Tuesday.
Yeah, so midway through the year, then we went back to our original kind of commitment for anyone who'd subscribed that we would do four a month, and then we just made it two on Tuesday and two on Saturday.
Yeah, when we started it, we did them together, just trying to figure out what was going on. We did that together for, 6 or 8 months, and then we split. Basically based on me being old and tired at night and him having kids, little kids to take care of.
So it worked out. That's right.
Yeah. That Tuesday nights were good for me and Saturday mornings were good for him.
Yeah. So then switched over.
And what kind of participation do you have there? I've been there a couple of times. It's not just me. But
Let's see. It depends on, it depends on time of year to a degree. It depends on what the topic is, or sometimes if there's a special guest. Like the teacher interviews where we have a special guest, like when you came in, those basically we always kind of open up and we share the recording and everything else. Those tend to have more people coming. Generally, I think what's the max we've had is about 8 people. On average, we probably have about 3 to 5. And in, let's see, we've have, basically, we wonder, we're still looking at what are the barriers that are there, seen or unseen, for people joining, whether it's the name, the teacher's room, whether it's the times. For some people, it's the times, like we have friends in Europe who say they just can't make either session because it's either middle of the workday or middle of the night for them. Or else just, you know, people have other commitments and so forth.
And certainly the subscription as well, people who just don't want to pay.
That's right. And yeah, we wrestled a long time about whether we should make it free or have something. We didn't want to make it a burden on anybody in any way. We also considered about whether we could have different pricing to match different people's level of, like, relative level of income depending upon where they were located, and whether we could cross subsidize between wealthier countries in general and you know, developing nations and so forth. But it's very, very difficult to set up in reality like that. But yeah, basically we wanted to make sure that we could cover at least some of the costs, even though we basically we volunteer our time into hosting and to promoting it and so forth. The kind of the hope would be that, you know, if you get enough people joining, then, and everybody making a small contribution, then we're able to then pay the hosts or pay special guests and so forth, just as like you know, like a stipend or an appreciation for their time or commitment and so forth. But yeah, I haven't quite cracked that nut, but we do have a dedicated core set of teachers who come pretty regularly and have done so and support.
I would say the core members are not there. I've seen people coming in from other countries who are pretty much interested in practicing their English and talking about teaching. And then people who have paid are pretty much into, they're pretty much people who know us and know that we've had lots of experiences, and I tend to have lots of ideas, and then Phil tends to have great ways of doing things, and he's very, very thorough, and really have so many between us. We have lots of ideas and methodologies, and what we say, we can usually back up where it's coming from, kind of theoretical underpinning kind of stuff. And so we've had teachers come in and say, oh my God, I wish, and I've said, I wish I had a mentor type person I could, you know, talk to when I was in my first 5-10 years of teaching. I would have killed to have somebody I could trust to talk to about what was going on in my classroom that week.
We did some things too, where we did like monthly topics, which were basically decided by teachers who came. And for example, we decided amongst the teachers who were coming regularly, we said, okay, let's look at drama in ELT. And we focused on that for a month. And basically, eventually we moved to kind of a model of a 4-week model of number one, find out what everybody currently knows about a topic. And then from there, we then see, well, what don't we know? What would we like to know? And go off and kind of do a little bit of reading or research on it, and both practical as well as theoretical stuff. Then come back and discuss and it, and then learn from there, and then go away, try things in our classroom, and then come back and talk about what we tried. We found that worked as a good kind of cycle. And I found that by doing that, you know, then we were all growing. And then you feel like, oh yeah, there's a kind of a real learning taking place. But yeah, it's sometimes it's quite difficult for people to also then commit 4 weeks, for example, on a weekend or a Friday night.
Yeah, if you're going to commit, that's like something you should be paid for, I suppose.
But also for the participants to commit that time as well. Yeah. Most people are kind of juggling family and work and other things as well.
But we're in the middle of a big discussion right now. It was very timely when you asked us in preparation for this, you asked about the teacher's room and stuff, and we are, it's really interesting. I mean, doing any small business, we love the idea of the teacher's room, and that I've been in teacher's rooms that were at schools, at high schools, at universities or language schools, and they were just buzzing with ideas and energy. And then there were other teacher's rooms where everybody was really dark and surly. You know, and so we wanted to kind of promote this idea of, cheerful, Phil and Stephen will talk with anybody about anything on teaching. But yet it's funny that it could be that the idea of the teacher's room is not something, everybody's been in a teacher's room, mm-hmm. but nobody's ever paid to be in that teacher's room.
Right.
You know, that's a benefit of part of your job. So
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because, yeah. you know, it's like when you guys got together with your MA or what we're doing with Webheads, you know, the people just can feel free to pop in. It seems maybe, I don't know, do you have any space like that where people could or just feel welcome to come? It could be a
well, we're planning to now. I mean, we're not ready to announce it in exactly which form, but we're going back to that direction where that that the new whatever it's going to be called, and you're welcome to brainstorm with us after this show. But trying to come up with what's the, you know, it's like the think tank or the water fountain or, you know, just some kind of image that people that would be probably a non-paying thing or even the freemium model that that if you you know. Phil has been, we've all been approached at different times to, you know, would you spend a month or two working with me, helping me on this particular action research project, or edit my MA with me, or, you know, these kind of side jobs.
That's not free.
No, of course. Right. Yeah. But I'm saying those kinds of things have come up, but we're trying to think of what's the, you know, that would be some kind of freemium model. So everybody's free to come in. But if you wanted to do some kind of, you know, tutoring or mentoring extra, you could buy that. Right. And that's one model of it.
We were talking, you're being one of the organizers of the JALT conference. And what IATEFL does, how they stream their content basically at their conferences, which is really great because what it does is it makes a hook. It brings people in. It shows the people the quality that's there. That's actually something that I've been quite impressed with you. It's obviously quality in this.
Thank you.
You know, I was just wondering how, you know, it's a quality, but also a willingness to share it and not totally driven by money. And whereas if you look at TESOL, they don't stream anything. I get emails from them all through the year. When are you going to buy a packet of recordings? Yeah, I mean, okay, now if I want that kind of recording, I'll go on the IATEFL site and watch it, or organize my own. But
listen, Vance, I was the PR for the conference working with Marcos Benavides back in 2008. And we talked about live streaming back then. And it's taken me 10 years. This year was the first year we got live streaming because I was one of the conference co-chairs with Catherine
Oakley. At JALT.
Proposing to them 10 years ago, you know, before IATEFL, that this would be a great outreach. And the reaction was vehemently, nobody will come to our conference.
Exactly. But it's the opposite, isn't it?
It's the opposite.
That's kind of what you need. You need something that will, that people can have for free. Just see what's there, you know.
Yeah, I watched a bunch of those interviews and plenaries at IATEFL, and my only reaction is, geez, I want to be there.
Exactly, these are your rock stars.
Yes.
Yeah, you want to go and see what they, you know, you want to interact with them. You can interact.
Man, when you're sitting in a room and you present this idea, and 20 people go, "Oh my God, no." Nobody will come to the conference if they can watch it on their computers at home.
And you monetize something else.
Like this.
Stephen Down says content wants to be free. Content is free. You shouldn't have to pay for content. Would you pay for something like the certificate at the end of it or some augmentation of the, you know, personal attention or a t-shirt, sell t-shirt, you know, but sure. I mean, just, but there's monetization comes after.
Yes.
You've got their foots in the door, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's what we're trying to figure out. And
but I'm not an expert on this. I don't monetize anything. I'm not a good example of it.
Right. But so, I mean, and it's literally taken so long to get to that point, you know, that but it seems like the live streaming we did this year, we had some technical issues, you know, and I guess you always do. And we're fixing them as much as possible in post-production. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, that's gonna, you know, increase interest in Jolt, not stop people from going.
Yeah, I think you've got two things too that happen, like with the IATF. One, you see the plenaries like you did with the JOUT as well, but you also see some of the things on the side, like the interviews, or there'll be videos, like you also see YouTube videos of people enjoying themselves at conference. And you know, when you see people having a good time, that's what makes you feel like, oh yeah, I want to be part of that, and I've got quality content, you know. And for people who can't make it, like me, I'm overseas, I wouldn't have been able to make it anyway. So, you know, I appreciate the service, but then again, you know, then I share it on Facebook and so on social media, then more people hear about it. And somebody somewhere might be like, actually, yeah, I could go next year. I do want to go next year.
Yeah. So, and if Phil shared it on Facebook, it must be good, is what somebody's thinking.
Was there anything else in the emails that I sent you that you wanted to talk about?
There's just one. One came up.
Okay.
Yeah, one came up was Ira Glass, IRA, and then Glass, GLASS. He he has this, if you search it on internet, he has a TV or a podcast kind of show. Mm-hmm. And he's been doing it for 20 years. Uh-huh. And he has this 1 minute message that I've shown to lots of people because it hit me so hard. And he said the first 10 years doing it, the shows were terrible, but yet he knew that they were terrible. And he had, the only thing that saved him was that he knew he had good taste, and he knew he had a good vision of what it could be when it was good. It was trying to be good, but it wasn't quite good yet. Mm-hmm. And that's what kept him going, and that he always says you just have to produce a whole volume of work to get good enough to be where you want to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been kind of something that I share with Phil and with Barb Sakamoto and Gareth Knight and Scott Thornbury, is that we know ideally what this could be, what ITDI could be in its perfect form. And we're nowhere near there yet, you know, and the biggest struggle we have right now is that there's like four or five of us at the core doing this in a couple of hours a day after our day jobs, you know, so we need more help and we need more ideas and stuff, but we do have a vision of what it could be. Mm-hmm. And that's what we keep working towards.
And you're almost at the 10-year mark.
Yeah, that's right.
Another year or two to go and you're going to be good.
We might crack it at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what you said, the quality you mentioned. I mean, both Phil and I smiled when you said that word, because that's kind of what we live for. We live for people's comments saying, that was a cool course we took, or that was a great webinar, or that was, you know, that was a great post. Thanks for sharing that. Phil spends countless hours a week putting up good content, because we know content is king, you know, and on social media, you need to be regular and dependable. And it's like anything I see from Edutopia, I know it's going to be excellent. Anything from, what's his name, Larry Ferlazzo, the high school teacher, it's going to be excellent. So you're putting your reputation out there, I guess. But that's what we're aiming for, is getting to that point that we know it's as good as we would like it to be.
You know? That could be a really good note to end on.
Yeah.
That was a nice, strong statement.
Yeah.
And I know you guys are, it's late in Japan. Must be 10 o'clock there night. 10 o'clock
it is
night.
Now, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not fair to keep you up and you give your time so freely as it is.
Right.
So,
Bill, do you have anything?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any last words?
Yeah, I think actually I was just kind of like, on a similar note, I just wanted to just share as well, I think something that we all share, but also Barb was talking about. And, you know, at the end of the day, you've got people who are dedicating their time, expertise, and so forth into creating that good content. They've got experience and so forth. And, you know, a lot of people do go above and beyond in terms of how much they put in and how much they support the courses that they do run. But obviously we want to be able to make sure that we can continue to produce that quality and attract that quality. So on that side of things, then yes, we have to have a model that is sustainable from a business sense of, but at the same time, you know, we maintain that dedication to supporting teachers who can't afford to otherwise. And we, yeah, that's going to always be at the heart of what we do.
Nice.
Yeah. So thank you very much for
talking
Ross. To us. We'll do it again. We've done it. So we've almost got a once a month thing. I guess I can pop by the teacher's room at some time.
You can anytime. You're always welcome.
Okay.
We'll see what it ends up. It won't be the teacher's room from January. We're going to come up with some sexy name for it. You know, the fitting room or something. I don't
might have to run a competition in December.
Mm. Yeah, right. That was your idea.
Right. To rename it, right?
Well, my impression is it's the, like you said, the water cooler, or there's always a staff room, you know,
right. Yeah.
And that's where people go and they relax and they talk to one another.
Yeah.
Right.
The boys' room. Yeah. Thanks, Vance.
Okay.
It's fun talking with you. I'm getting a little, this is the second time and it's left me wanting more. We're in tune, aren't we?
We share
ideas and it seems really, really cool. I love this 20, 30, 40 thing too.
Yeah. And learning together is basically what it is. And it's just getting people to come out, like 430 episodes, they're all recorded. Well, maybe we've lost a couple along the way, but we got way over 400 videos and or voice recordings or whatever, and they're all indexed, and there's quite a trove back there. Now you're a part of it.
Amazing. So,
thank you very much for inviting and having us.
Yeah, well, I just mentioned it was Learning Together 430, and it's the 21st of November and 2019. In case you're listening a couple of years from now, you'll know when we were here.
That's true. So,
that's something I really hate when people do podcasts and they don't say the date. You know, you don't know when did they do that. Anyway.
Thank you, Vance.
Okay. Nice to talk to you. And cheers. We'll do a little brainstorming later on. I don't know. Did you want to stay on after this or did you want?
I'm going to wrap up, I think. Go brush my teeth and I got to get up at 5.
Okay. Yep. Oh, yeah. Okay. So what do
you're
I
still
have
recording,
to
right?
Yes, I'm still recording.
I just turned off the recording.
Stop recording. I'm going to stop. Yeah. At my end.